Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another episode of Midrats. If you're new to the show and you want to join in with all the usual suspects that are with us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room. And if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show or a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's a great place to put it because we'll be watching it as the show goes forward and more than happy to steal your good ideas. And if you have to take care of some business halfway during the show and you want to catch up later for what you missed, you can always get the full podcast over at the Blog Talk Radio Archive. That's where you'll also find all of our previous shows if you want to catch up on them. Or you can just take the shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other aggregators you might use. But hey, let's go ahead and dive into today's subject. And as in many things in life, cliches exist for a reason because more often than not, they're accurate. And kind of as a background are two of the cliches that I think that are foundation to our discussion are the old saws, knowledge is power and information is currency. And there's a reason why those with a grasping desire for power often go after the press and the free flow of information. It's also why, along with religion, free speech, assembly, redress of grievance, a free press was in the First Amendment to our Bill of Rights. And in our republic, I think one of the nicer things is it ebbs and flows and has different personalities. But there's always been a pretty good communication relationship, at least in my lifetime, between the press and its military from the low point of the Vietnam War going forward. And what we wanted to talk about today was the status of that communication with the press, and in this case, the defense and the military press, and that responsibility that they have to help communicate to the taxpayers and the citizens of our country what their money and their nation is doing, specifically when it comes to its nation's defense. And we want to talk today about how that has changed, how some things may have gotten better, may have gotten worse, and what are some of the second and third order indications of the direction that that relationship has taken recently. And our guest for the full hour to bring this topic to the front is an actual professional, Sam Legrone. Sam is the editor of USNI News, and he's covered legislation, acquisition, and operation for the sea services since 2009. He's also got a little bit of underway time with the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Marine Corps, and our friends up north in Canada. Sam, welcome to Midrats.
Hey there. How y'all doing?
We're hanging in there this summer. And hey, kind of a scene setter, building on the opening. And I kind of became aware of it, the shift and the change, and I don't mean this anything negative as the individual in general, just as policies usually derive from the top. But I saw that shift in the communication flow and how open that aperture was roughly when CNO Richardson came on and then when Secretary of Defense Mattis came on as well. And other people have talked about how that communications and the ability to actually report on the goings-on in the military has narrowed in the last couple of years. As somebody whose bread and butter job is in that specific arena, talk for a little bit about how you've seen that shift over the last couple of years and how that is impacting the ability of the military oppressed to do its job?
I think there's a couple of different spheres you have to think about here when you start to have this conversation. So first of all, you know, there's the Navy in and of itself as an organization and how they've handled their own communications, and then the OSD, you know, big Pentagon writ large. But if you want to think about how the Navy's been communicating, there was a pretty pronounced shift when Admiral Richardson took the helm of the Navy back in 2015, right? September 2015, he released John Greener. And pretty quickly, I think, the culture of the submariner kind of comes up to the fore, where that's what you think about is, you know, this idea of like, well, we don't really talk that much about operations because we don't have to. We don't talk that much about capabilities because we don't have to. And if you look at Admiral Richardson's biography, it's pretty much, with the exception, I think, of a White House tour, is pretty much all submarines, operational submarines, throughout his career. And, you know, it was pretty unique getting pulled from reactors to be the chief of naval operations. So that being said, you have a senior U.S. Navy Admiral with a single-digit lineal number, which hasn't had a whole lot of experience before this job with other parts of the Navy, or that are a little bit more communicative about, you know, what you're supposed to do. So if you're thinking about, you know, phase zero, phase one, order effects, part of that is, hey, we're out here, we're doing present stuff because we're on the surface or we're in the sky, and part of the reason that we're out here is that you can see us and you can see what you're doing. And I think just as, you know, probably a longer windup than I needed, but Admiral Richardson doesn't come from that culture in and of itself. And so pretty quickly after he takes the reins from Admiral Greener, who was also a submariner, but has had a lot of joint billets. He was Fleet Forces, he was Seventh Fleet Commander, you start to see kind of a change, especially in terms of capabilities, right? And then that sort of started slowly in, you know, 2015, rolling into 2016. And then you have a separate set of issues around the Pentagon leadership writ large when Secretary Mattis comes in and takes over. He really pretty quickly starts to stop or slow down conversations about readiness, right? So it's very difficult to have conversations about the status of an individual unit or the status of a particular type of system, like, you know, the F-18 aviation has kind of taken it on the chin a little bit. I mean, they've been operationally used quite a bit. Class C mishaps are up. There was some good work from the Military Times on that. There's this physiological episode. And then from what we've been hearing, Secretary Mattis isn't super excited about, you know, readiness shortfalls getting out into the public sphere. But then again, you know, you're talking about a very senior member of the administration that hasn't spent a ton of time in D.C. I mean, he's always been on the operational edge. And I think for both of those folks, you know, there's aspects of, you know, sharing information and the benefits of sharing information in particular contexts. I think with Secretary Mattis on the D.C. side, you know, that you need to, that's part of the dance on the Hill, right? You know, you tell people like, oh, woe is us. You know, these units can't go. Please give us this pot of money. And then I think on the Richardson, on the operational side, in particular, on the capability side, nobody talks about submarines because you don't talk about submarines.
What, this is kind of an odd way for me to approach this, but in your mind, some information should be normally accessible to the American public. And that's clearly something not to be reportable. But is there a distinction between that and information that gets leaked and the nature of the kind of reporting that you have to deal with in those situations? Does that make sense?
So let me make sure I understand. So there's the stuff that, like, the Pentagon and the services put out, and then, you know, other stuff that we find that comes over the transom. Is that kind of the gist?
Yeah. The difference between a leak and normally released information, and you know, some of that's going to depend on, I guess, the level of the leak. I mean, highly classified information, as compared to just like right now, until recently, maybe, or until shortly in the future, in-serve reports are classified. How do we deal with that kind of situation?
Sure. Well, so let's make this a 26. I'll tell you the 2016 answer, and then I'll tell you the 2018 answer. So in 2016, we had a pretty clear understanding, USNI News did, with the Navy on what information we can get about operations, more or less, right? So that means that we have a pretty good idea of ship positions. We have a pretty good idea of sort of where people are deployed to. We have a pretty good idea of what presence operations are going. We have a little bit of an understanding of kind of the exercise schedule in advance. And we spend a lot of time, in particular, talking to the ENCODES and the OPNAV staff about, you know, aviation requirements coming up and surface requirements coming up. And then it's a pretty, you know, the expectations are very clear from everybody on the other end, right, on the stuff that we're supposed to, that we're trying to get at. And then that's what the Navy puts out. They had a, you know, here's a pretty good example. So a sailor runs into, has an accident or dies at sea, depending on the AOR, like an email goes out to the press distro that says, okay, you know, we have a sailor, they're missing, or they've been injured, or they died. This is the status. This is all that we have. You know, unfortunately, if the sailor dies, then, you know, you report that, and then you wait 24 hours for next of kin identification, and then you do something with, you know, the sailor's identity and say, this is who they were, this is what they were doing, and then wait until the investigation concludes and then report the results of that investigation. And that's pretty standard. And so the expectation was, is if it happened in fifth fleet or sixth fleet or seventh fleet, those PAOs would give us the information and they would send it out to the folks that are tracking. And then you would go and have an idea of what's up, and then go and report that. In 2018, we had a poor sailor, Ensign Mitchell, who died in the Red Sea, and those procedures weren't followed the same way. Instead of sending an email out to the distro, if we put it on their website but didn't highlight it, I think a lot of the reporters had heard about it was when Colonel Manning, who is the press director for the offices of Secretary of Defense, mentioned it in a roundup of things that had happened over the weekend, and it caught a lot of us off guard because we usually expect that distro email. And like, look, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt because, you know, there's been a lot of turnover in a lot of these billets as far as command, and then, you know, who those public affairs officers are who work extremely hard. That being said, that's something that kind of fell through the cracks. And I think the difference is if you look at public affairs as an extension of commander's intent, well, you know, there might have been a misstep there, but then I think, you know, that operational detail not getting highlighted in a particularly how should I put that in the way that I think we normally would expect it to, I don't think it bothered a lot of commanders going like, oh, okay, well, it's just not. That's not exactly how, you know, we're doing it now, but I don't want to be glib about, you know, especially a sailor who's dying, but it feels like that it's no longer an imperative to be very clear about, you know, for example, an operational death in the same way that it was 2 years ago.
As a perfect example. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no. And then I was about to say it. And then ultimately, you know, so that's an example of that's an example of stuff that our expectations and stuff that we would expect to happen, you know, back in 2016 and the difference in 2018. And then, you know, leaked stuff, highly classified stuff is almost usually never worth it for us. You know, the stuff where it gets tricky is if stuff is unclassified, distribution statement, whatever, or it's FOUO, or what have you. So a lot of that stuff you get through FOIAs, and that's one thing. So you start to see FOIA come back with, you know, different explanations on why you can't have that information. People treat FOUO really seriously now, before they used to in 2016. It's on an individual case basis, but then we would have people like, or, you know, we would be able to obtain, you know, information about like upcoming, like, modernizations and like what is this modernization going to look like, especially for the carriers, right? For the RCO agents. And we used to get a lot of detail there. Now, not so much. It's getting harder and harder because I think, you know, you have these dual, especially in the Navy, so you have, CNO saying, hey, you probably shouldn't talk about capabilities that much and, like, future stuff. And then you also have on the OSD side, like, hey, we really shouldn't be talking about readiness that much. And so you have these people or you have these folks in NAVSEA and you have folks throughout, you know, the operational part of the Navy. It was just like, well, you know, what can we talk about? Maybe we should just dial it back and be quiet because there's no real incentive, I think, for people to kind of get out in front of their skis and really tell a good story because the risks have gotten higher. So sorry, I didn't mean to cut off that idea, but that's sort of the difference between like 2 years ago and now. That's kind of how I think about it in my head.
No, it actually flows right into my next question as well, because, you know, there's that famous General Sherman quote, I hate newspaper men. They come into camp and pick up camp rumors and print them as facts. I regard them as spies, which in truth they are, unquote. There's a tradition here of having a little bit of an attitude towards the press and the military. But what I have found disappointing is there's a legit issue about classification issues, but I've never really seen that as a problem. You know, you saw some of it back in the glory days of, I think, openness, which was the middle part of the 2000s, 2003 to maybe 2007 or so, when you had embedded reporters all over the place. You know, one of the guys that back when I started blogging in 2004 that I followed was, I think his last name was Prakash. He's still on active duty. Anyway, Armageddon, he was an Army guy, did some great blogging, and the Army shut him down with a sledgehammer because he was, quote, sending classified information, which, no, he wasn't. They just didn't control it. And you've also seen a few circumstances where things have tightened up, not over issues of classification, but over embarrassment and control. And I can appreciate where they're trying to get that needle between the control and being able to have an open relationship, relatively open two-way relationship with the press. You know, where do you see the high watermark for that relationship was? And do you see that a lot of it has to do with just control and embarrassment, or have you seen some really serious potential classification issues?
Well, I got to tell you right now that, I mean, the number one thing on my end is, you know, they'll never tell me if there's some potential classification issues. Like, I'll never know. Like, we've, you know, a couple of times we've written some stuff. We've written some stuff, I think, where we kind of cobble together some common sense ideas, particularly around some of the digital warfare initiatives and how you're doing. I don't know if we still talk about naval integrated fire control counter air. I'm not quite sure if that's still a topic that people talk about. But you know, I've had people tell us that, hey, you wrote some stuff that, you know, was extremely classified or at least secret. And I was just like, I don't know. Because it's not my business to know unless it's explicitly told to me that like, this is secret. And then I have to make a value judgment because it's one of those things. It's not like, you know, I mean, I can't speak to other shops, but I know from our side, it's like whenever we have to deal with something that's like secret and we know it's secret, we're just like, oh, nerves, because it's 80% of the time it's more trouble than it's worth, right? I want a general understanding of a particular program or a particular situation, and I don't need that level of detail for the most part to tell people what's going on with a particular system or with a particular initiative inside a military service. That or operationally, you know, I mean, I'm happy not to you know, make sure that, you know, everyone's operations and their operational security stays as tight as it needs to be. So that's one of the frustrating things for me is when, I think for everybody, I mean, I'm not unique here, but I think it's one of the frustrating things for a lot of people in this business when they say it's like, hey, you know, we can't talk about that because it's secret or it's FOUO or it's whatever, and we're not going to give you any information about that. And honestly, lately it's been like we can't even really give you a steer off the record on what exactly is going on to just, you know, help you make your decision process. So a lot of that is in the vacuum. So how much of it is embarrassment because of, you know, somebody did something bad and they're trying to maybe get out of the newspaper versus there's a legitimate concern here about classification that could, you know, compromise either an operation or a program, I don't know, because it's all presented in the same way, you know, with dire warnings that if kind of step out of line, that, you know, something terrible is going to happen. And that happens less with us because, again, you know, we don't do a whole lot of special operations coverage and we don't do a whole lot of submarine operation stuff, obviously. So, you know, it's a lot of surface stuff and a lot of aviation stuff for us. And that's pretty wide open, wide out there. So we don't know. We don't know for the most part. We're told that, like, this is sensitive or we're not going to talk about this because of X, Y, Z. We don't know if it's because they are embarrassed, or we don't know if there's a legitimate security reason. But what we do know is what people can and can't talk about, it's mostly to cannot talk about, and the scope of that information is getting wider and wider and wider.
When you look at information that should be reported, you know, what the public needs to know or ought to know, how broad are the categories? I mean, is it the readiness, the overall readiness of the Navy, or down to specific units? Is it, I mean, what kind of categories should the public be informed of in your mind?
Okay. Well, I mean, from my perspective, what do they need to know to make a decision about their taxpayer dollars? And, you know, a big, we weren't seeking to do this when we started USNI News back in 2012, 2013. Gosh, it feels like a long time ago. But we found that one of our big constituencies now is investors in Wall Street. So we have a lot of people who are voting, you know, with their dollar in the marketplace based on an understanding of the success or failure of a particular system. Honestly, I think what the public should know is, you know, as far as naval forces go, is generally where their ships are and kind of what they're doing. I mean, don't give us the – the system on the on a particular platform or that the Navy has to use. So they're in a particular situation where they might have to use them, people understand what the stakes are, right? And, you know, when I say the public, you know, a lot of this goes to, you know, maybe some of the lesser informed legislatures, right? You know, which is also kind of part of this. As far as new stuff coming up, you know, we're asking taxpayers to invest a lot of or the Navy's asking a lot of taxpayers to invest a lot of treasure into a particular system, right? And understanding what it's supposed to do and how it fits into the order of battle, I think that's, you know, that's probably something that the public should know. And when you say the public, that's like, you know, you got Katz and Peel all the way up to the, you know, the folks over at the Atlantic Center, or I'm sorry, at the Atlantic Council or like CNA, DC think tank folks. And so it's a pretty broad swath of people. and they all had sort of different ideas, you know. So I think the folks in Peoria would be like, you know, just, you know, they know, okay, like, these guys will keep us safe from ballistic missiles. That's fine with me, right? And then you go up to folks over at, you know, CNAS or CSIS or the folks that are the think tanks, and we're like, well, is this a, is this terminal sea-based missile defense, or is this, you know, high-altitude intercept, or, you know, because that fits into this paper that I'm doing to, you know, try and help understand the strategy. So, I mean, it depends on the audience, but, like, mostly, you know, general capabilities of platforms, things that the U.S. can do, you know, and keep the super secret stuff super secret. You know, I'm not interested in exposing that, because ultimately, as a newsman, the benefits for me are negligible, honestly. So, I mean, I think in a nutshell, I think that's what that is. It's like, how are we spending our taxpayer dollars? Please make the argument of why this is a good idea.
Well, kind of a practical point of view, you know, one of the things that, at least on the maritime side of the house, that I thought would have gotten more play than it did, but maybe it's because of the communication, was Truman's recent abbreviated deployment. How was that really groundbreaking is a strong word, and I'm having trouble coming up with the right word, but it was very different pattern, different idea, different concept than what we had seen as the new normal for deployments for the last half decade or so. How did the Navy report on the Truman deployment compared to previous ones?
I actually felt pretty good about the Truman deployment. So I think we were caught a little off guard, you know, when we were starting to hear back from folks that, like, oh yeah, you know, Truman's on this side of Greenland. We're like, wait, what now? They chop into fleet horses? When? Oh, they left in April, right? This is July. So that caught us a little off guard. But I went back and I read the coverage. We did actually a pretty long, extensive interview with Cino Richardson, Megan Eckstein, the incomparable Megan Eckstein, the deputy editor over USNI News. Took a trip with him up to Newport and spent a lot of time on the on the plane with them, and they chatted quite a bit. And the concept that they're putting out was dynamic force employment. Right? The idea that, you know, to fit in line with the national defense strategy, that you need to be strategically predictable and operationally unpredictable. So you could go and move around. You can go and move around and do specific things with your aircraft carrier, with whatever, whenever you needed to. So the they telegraphed that actually pretty explicitly, like, you know, you can do this stuff with aircraft carriers, any deployment. And we're just like, oh, okay, yeah. And so we write it up. And then we started noticing the Truman's deployment was different when they didn't go through the Suez Canal, because, you know, when a warship goes through a narrow choke point like the Suez or Bab al-Mandeb or the Strait of Hormuz, you usually hear about it. There's enough public stuff out there that, you know, oh, okay, even if Fifth Fleet didn't want to talk about, you know, those transitions, you'll find out about it pretty readily, just because, you know, there's enough people out there and there's the internet, and, you know, you can see an aircraft carrier there on the Suez pretty easily. So we heard when it went through Gibraltar, and it was in the Atlantic after, oh gosh, I want to say it was in May. It was either in June or late May or in June, where the Truman transitioned closer to the UK and getting ready to do some exercises with France with a really big strike group. I mean, we're talking, there were six DDGs, a cruiser, plus the German guided missile frigate. And so we probably should have gotten hints early on that, okay, this is different. But it was telegraphed that they did a pretty good job of telegraphing, like, look, your expectations on this one are going to be a little different. And then when they turned around and they came back to port, I think enough local reporters in Norfolk had figured it out, right? You know, people talk at the hairdresser, and then, you know, it kind of trickled into, you know, sort of the consciousness of the local media down there, which is usually pretty good about predicting when things come back, because you can tell, right? You know, Somebody I knew who was stationed in Busan told me the other day. It was just like, hey, a submarine's coming in. I was like, how do you know? It's like, the taxi drivers all know. They're just getting ready to, like, you know, pick people up. So that one wasn't that bad. I think, you know, that deployment is just like, they're on this side, and they're like, they communicated that, like, we're going to be doing things differently now. And and then I think when we called police forces, they were very helpful and told us everything that they could. And so I felt actually pretty good about how that went down, because, you know, you're talking about a pretty non-traditional carrier deployment where they're back doing, according to Admiral Moran, Vice Chief of Naval Operations, they're doing a working port visit in Norfolk, and they can ship out at any time. That's what he said on Monday when we went down for his all-hands call. So, okay, so that all makes sense. There were some opportunities for that to go sideways, but I felt the communication plan for that was pretty good. Fleet Forces has been pretty, since Admiral Grady's taken over, you know, their communication staff's been pretty good about talking about what they can talk about, and very clear about talking about what they can't talk about. So that part has been pretty good. So as far as the Truman deployment goes, I don't have any complaints from my end or from our organization.
I don't know if you've embedded or gone to sea with some of the units since the Admiral Richardson took over as CNO, but when you do go as an embed or out to sea with one of these units, how are you treated, and are you looking for certain things based on the nature of the kind of embed you're on?
It depends on the kind of embed that you're on. I haven't, I've been doing more DC stuff lately, so I haven't been to sea since, it's been a couple of years since I've been out. We send Megan, on a pretty regular basis. So she does a lot of, underway. She's actually just getting back from RIMPAC right now. And so I think she was on Adelaide. And then I think she was on, I think the Vincent's out there right now supporting the exercise. So, it, you know, a lot of it has to do with what the Navy wants you there to look at. So last time I went out, it was a F-35C test, and it was pretty open. It was just like, hey, here's the squadron commander for the VX squadron commander is sitting here and talking to you about, like, this is what we're doing here. The pilots are pretty accessible, and then you get to go and talk to people about, I think it was on the bush. And then you talk to people about, you know, what it's like handling the aircraft. And that's all pretty straight ahead. Like, once you get underway, for the most part, it's, you know, people are more or less understand what they can talk about and what they can't talk about. And sometimes they're a little bit more prescribed than other times. I really enjoy, so the carrier visits usually, you know, if you're a journalist, they do the DV route, right? The distinguished visitor. And if you're there for an overnight, you're in that set of 12 staterooms that are reserved for fancy people. And then journalists, I wouldn't call us fancy people. And you go, and pretty much the entire time, there's like at least a chief or a petty officer, first class at your elbow, if you're not getting into trouble, or at least that's been my experience since I've been there. I really enjoy going out with the Gators. Because usually once they sign you over to the Marines, they're like, all right, if you're not here at this LCAC load on at 05, we're just going to leave you on this ship. Have a great time. So, I mean, it varies from ship to ship, but I usually find that when we get in front of sailors and Marines and we just ask them questions about their job, they're usually extremely enthusiastic. They know what they can talk about. They know what they can't talk about. And for the most part, you know, and I'm not going to waste anybody else's time because, you know, I got work to do.
Have you had a chance to communicate with some of the navies or their versions of PAOs and CHINFO, like the British Navy, the French, or the Dutch? And is there a different approach that you've seen as an American, predominantly reporting on American military issues, and how the media in other countries report on their military?
It's actually, I mean, I so a few years ago, I used to work for James Defense Weekly. I was their U.S. maritime correspondent, and my editor at the time, I can't remember what I was complaining about. It was NAVSEA taking 2 weeks to answer a question or something like that, and he was like, "Hey Sam, you need to just fill your role for a minute and just put yourself in a perspective where, you know, the type of access that the American press has on a daily basis to officials and equipment and being able to go out underway is leaps and bounds ahead of what the English and the French get. The Pentagon is still pretty much the only place, only military headquarters in the world that has a standing press corps. You know, we have a desk there. We're on the hallways unfettered. That's pretty unique in the world. So the folks in Britain and France and pretty much everywhere else don't get that level of access. So that's a big deal. So their press, especially on the trade side, have to rely a lot more, honestly, on like open source photo recognition, right? Like hanging out in Portsmouth and looking to see what's hanging on the ships coming in, coming out. I mean, granted, they had a lot of contact with industry, but they have to work a lot harder to go and get the same access that we enjoy, which is like, to put it in perspective, it's frustrating now, but, you know, I'd rather do it here still than in Britain and the UK.
How, as you look around at the other reporting, not the USNR news reporting, but of other people reporting on defense matters, how do you view what other people are doing? I mean, is there a fairly knowledgeable group out there? Is there another group that doesn't seem to understand what's going on, but gets excited about things that probably don't matter that much in the great scheme of thing? Or are people are there some people who don't get excited enough about stuff they should be excited about?
I value all of my colleagues equally, and they're all doing a wonderful job.
Okay.
No, I'll say that it's a little less now, but I think 4 or 5 years ago, there was a burst in defense verticals pretty much all over the place. There were a lot of places where you wouldn't expect to have a defense-focused publication or a defense-focused like news service, because I think a lot of marketing people saw that as an opportunity to get some, you know, Lockheed Martin advertising, some Boeing advertising, so whatever. So I think there's some people in management in places that were not, you know, the usual gang, where they looked at it and was like, oh, this is a great big cash grab. You know, let's stand up a couple guys, and you know, they'll go through and they'll look at stuff and they'll be like, oh, this is crazy, and then they'll go and they'll write up like stories like, this is why XYZ will beat XYZ in a particular scenario or whatever. And you know, I mean, it's a little bit more oriented towards the you know, people who are fans, I guess, less enthusiasts or more enthusiasts of sort of military hardware, and less about like, well, what do you actually do with this in a war, and how do you pay for it, and you know, all the boring stuff that we do. And there was a glut of those for a while, and you know, a couple of them are still around, and you know, it's fine. I think the trade. The trade press in and of itself is, I mean, there's a lot of good people working right now. I think the trade press in and of itself is contracted, and there's a lot less people doing this work for about as many publications. So you're starting to see the cream cheese spread across a lot of different places. I would pay attention to, you know, the amount of people that are working for individual shops, because that's going down. And, so the stuff that we do, the end-to-end kind of DoD 5000 programmatics, and we're starting to do less of that now. There's less people doing that work, that really kind of granular, like, okay, milestone A turns into milestone B, turns into milestone C, turns into an LRIC contract, turns into a full production contract. you know, into block zero, into block one, into block whatever. And that really kind of nitty-gritty granular stuff, there's less and less people doing that. And the demand is still there because there's still, you know, a lot of organizations that are kind of going and attempt it. But, you know, I think a lot of the practitioners are well-meaning, enthusiastic, and talented, but we're, especially on the Navy side, we're losing people experience. I mean, you know, my dear friend Chris Cavitz is out of the game now, and, you know, he was an institution in and out of himself, and the amount of information that he has out there. And, you know, and there's a lot of good reporters that are doing good work, but, you know, there's continuing to be less and less of them. But, I mean, it's not a situation that's unique to the trade press. I mean, it's pretty much universal kind of across the news game right now.
Now you can see that throughout media organizations all over the place. So we're at an inflection point and things will shake out eventually, but they're shedding employees all over the place. And you can see it both in military coverage, but also one of my pet peeves is my local newspaper. When I was growing up, it used to have a dedicated section on Sunday just for outdoors activities, i.e. hunting and fishing and stuff. Then it went to one page on Sundays. Now I think it's one page a month just because they don't have the people there. And you can also see it in local coverage where the newsrooms are so thinly populated that one or two reporters or editors that have a hobby horse or a pet interest can just dominate a newspaper to the point that it's no longer a general service newspaper. And one of the concerns that I've had, and at least in the defense reporting area, is as those cost pressures have had a narrowing of the people reporting, that the demand for information is still there. And there's always been a player out there that might step into the gap a bit. I won't use any names of people or organizations, but you know who I'm talking about. There are certain hired guns at certain things that ostensibly call themselves think tanks or institutes that produce a fair bit of writing on topics that rarely diverge from their underwriters' interests. Do you see that as something people need to be more and more aware of, in the U.S. at least, when it comes to reading about defense and military matters? It's always important to know where your information comes from, but more due diligence may be needed.
I think we're thinking about exactly the same sort of realm of publication. Yes, absolutely. I think there's a lot of folks in the D.C. sphere that write about defense issues, and it's not readily apparent that they're being supported by you know, certain points of view financially. And that's been around for a long time, but I think those voices are getting outsized now because the number of independent people that are doing this work is getting smaller. And I think it's always, you know, I mean, read the label, you know, try and figure out like where this organization is coming from, and, you know, who's supporting them and what they're, you know, do they have a point of view or do they have like a statement of kind of what they're all about, which is where I can put in a plug here for USNI News for your listeners real quick. I mean, as far as this stuff goes with us, because occasionally with our leadership, when they're like, hey, USNI News, or USNI is a think tank, when it's referred to in the press, it's like, no, it's not, it's hard to explain, but think tank's not quite fair because, you know, the idea of that sponsored content or sponsored, publications with a particular point of view of the sponsor is not something that we do. And we get pretty, we hold that line as closely as we can. I mean, we do have advertising from defense companies, but it's very much independent of any of those interests. And we have a pretty good, understanding with, I think, our readership that, you know, we're trying to get to objective truth the best that we can. you know, as well as we can, you know, quoting official sources whenever we can, producing documents whenever we can. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, there's people out there who are doing it. Again, you know, less and less folks out there. So you have to, you know, you just have to be like a conscious media consumer. It's like, where has this person written before? You know, what is this publication all about? I think it's a bigger problem in Europe. It's getting to be a problem here, but I think it's a bigger problem in Europe, where you have a lot of pay for play out there, you know, as far as, you know, coverage goes. And yeah, I mean, it's ultimately, you know, we're living in a world now where we're graduating more, public relations people than we are journalists right now. And, you know, whether or not I'm not here to comment whether or not that's a good or a bad thing, but I'm here to say that, like, you know, it will color the information that you produce, and you just have to be 100% sure, and you know where it's coming from if you're going to make decisions about it with, like, your money.
Well, that's sort of in addition to the journalist public relations differential. How much impact on or concern do you think it causes the Navy and the rest of the military, that there are so many citizen journalists now that with blogs and all this tweeting, Facebook stuff that goes on? I mean, how does that eat into the willingness of the senior leadership to discuss matters? Is that because it's almost instantaneous, or sides are taken on the various social media things, do you think?
It's really interesting, because sometimes, you know, I mean, there used to be an old saying, especially among the Navy journalists, is just like, you know, it's not the expose at CNN that gets you in trouble or gets the CNO mad at you. It's the trade publication with the very specific detail of the very specific program that, you know, gets you the phone call. And that being said, yeah, I feel that, you know, well, and hopefully I'm not incorrectly calibrated, but I feel that, like, a lot of the, like, the citizen journalists and the individual Twitter guys, I think, are less of an issue for the Navy. I mean, I think they're all very well read, Sal. I get that a lot. But it's the, I think the things that they get concerned about isn't necessarily the well-reasoned opinion. It's the wildly uninformed opinion that catches a lot of people's attention, right? And so, gosh, there was I saw a headline, and forgive me, I'm not getting it quite exactly, but I think it was the equivalent of, the Navy has admitted that the LCS is basically a piece of garbage, which is like, what? I've been following the LCS for the better part of 10 years, and I don't remember anybody at any point saying that it was a piece of garbage. And it was from a very well circulated publication, you know, general interest. And it's sort of a victim of this headline writing culture. It gets you to click on it, and then you read the headline, and you read maybe the first one or two paragraphs. And that's really, I think, you know, when people have problems with the stuff that we write, it's always like, hey, that headline isn't quite accurate, or that, you know, there is this fact in the first or second bit that isn't quite right. And, you know, we'll quibble back and forth. But I think that's the major concern. It's less so the, you know, sort of the individual person with the well-reasoned opinion. It's more so that, like, you know, there's a lot of, again, you know, we talked about a lot of these verticals that write about the military, and they just throw out some wacky headlines. They'll throw out some wacky headlines that kind of are not, make a big mountain out of a tiny molehill with specific stuff, but then that colors kind of the public perception. As to those programs, I think, you know, LCS obviously is one of those, you know, love it or hate it. The understanding of what it is and who likes it and who doesn't has been pretty cemented. And, you know, does it line up with facts? I mean, I'll leave it to other people to judge. But it's I think that's maybe more so a concern than the individual fire. Because I remember there were, like, you know, even as, you know, like 2008, 2009, when I started covering the military, you know, there was the era of the well-informed independent military blogger that, you know, that had their own site, and they were saying how it is. And that was a big concern then. I don't hear about that so much anymore. Not in the same way. I think the big concern is, as far as, like, you know, trying to shape the information environment, has to do with the, with these verticals, with these just wacky headlines.
You hit on one of my pet peeve. Maybe I just never noticed it before, but it seemed in the last few years, I don't know, maybe they all went to the same seminar or read the same book about how to get clicks and stuff, but the headline writers have got to stop with that. You know, I guess it's fine if you're, you know, covering the Kardashians or something, but in the military arena, and I've seen it, unfortunately, with some individuals, I know that the individual authors don't pick their headlines 90% of the time. Are 99% of the time, but there are some organizations there that somebody needs to have a come to Jesus meeting with people inside our lifelines and go, cut with the clickbait headlines. You're not doing yourself or your writers any good. I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned here, because it had me grin, because shocking but true. Through the years, I communicate with people on email and other venues about the things I write about. And a lot of them are, you know, JOs or even some midshipmen. And I say, hey, you really should write yourself. You know, you have some strong opinions on this. Put something together, write it. And, you know, you can send it to a couple places, send it over to USNI. I think they'd love to look at it. And there are some people that have some really interesting ideas about what the Naval Institute is and what it will or will not publish. You've been there a long time, and you're always a person that just lays it out there. If you could, you must see more of this than I do. What are some of the big misconceptions people have about the Naval Institute's mission and what it does or does not publish? And just, I know this is a 5-hour answer, but just in a minute or so, and what is that process that an individual would go through to get either published online or on DeadTree by the Naval Institute that they may not know exists?
Absolutely. So if you're a freelance journalist looking to pitch, you know, like news stories as a professional reporter, you come to me. You know, my Twitter handle is @slagrone, SLAGRONE, or email me at Sam @slagrone, SLAGRONE @usni.org if you're a freelance reporter. As far as the other, you know, so my position at the Naval Institute is very narrow, and we're like an objective news organization, and used to run opinion and analysis pieces, but we phased that out in favor of a lot more opportunities for the folks over at you know, the proceedings and the periodical side to go and like really help folks that are interested in that part of national security craft really good pieces. So the Naval Institute has proceedings. It's a peer-reviewed, almost academic journal on military affairs, naval affairs, and national security. It's, you know, you go and you submit it. If you go to usni.org and click on the proceedings link, you can find the submission guidelines there. And it'll give you an idea. You send it to the editors of proceedings. They go and they send it to the board, and it's about 12 to 15 military officers, and they go and they read it. They do a blind reading where, you know, they don't have anybody's name on it, they don't have anybody's rank on it, and they go and they judge it based on the merits of the idea, which is great. So it's the one place in the sea services where there's a real sort of meritocracy and real egalitarian view as to someone's idea. It's completely independent of, you know, any kind of you know, rank component. So that's proceedings. They've also stood up a program called Proceedings Live, which is able to get submissions that you would, 700 to 800 to 1,200 word submissions about stuff that needs to get out there right now, as opposed to the monthly magazine. And the proceedings folks do a good job of going through and editing those, and I think they're publishing 4 to 5 a week now. And then there's the USNI News blog, which is shaping, has been a place for, I think, where people have a lot of, talk a lot about their sort of individual experiences in service and their individual takes on certain issues. Sal, how would you describe it? You write a lot.
And some people just have a strange idea. I don't know why that things are constrained or restrained or controlled, at least on the USNI blog. There's a lot of stuff there that might not be what would work well on proceedings, or, there's only so many pages you can print stuff on. And as in anything else, if there are 10 things and there's room for two, maybe you're number 3, not number 10, and you still want your ideas out there. If anybody has an idea, they want to publish it. The sidebars on either side are pretty wide. There's lots of room to run. And I understand some people are concerned about publishing anything anywhere, but if somebody really wants to, at somewhere in that ecosystem, there's lots of places over at the Naval Institute and other places too that they can publish. People just need to realize that regardless of what you put out there, there will be people that disagree with you. You can publish "The Earth is Round and Water is Wet," and somebody will come in and will think that you're a crazy and insane person for believing that, but you just need to ignore them. If you want to be and have your ideas in the marketplace of ideas, you got to put it out there. And there are lots of different venues, entry-level positions or advanced positions for people to do that. It's just getting over that fear. I don't know what the secret sauce is to get people over that fear, but they just need to put it out there.
No, and I think there's plenty of examples, I think, of people who have put an idea out that might be controversial and might ruffle some feathers, but at the same time, if you feel passionate about it, you think it's going to improve things. I mean, it's absolutely worth getting out there. There's so many examples. My favorite is Admiral Nimitz and his very, very well thought out piece in, I want to say, 1929 about the operational use of submarines and how we should be getting more into the submarine business. When he was a Lieutenant J.G. Nimitz. I'm apologies for people who know this better than me, realize that I'm butchering it. But I mean, there's so many times, in parallel to pretty amazing innovations in the Navy where, that idea was kind of thought out, fleshed out, and worked over in the pages of proceedings. I mean, I think the examples are tremendous and the folks, inside the Naval Services that, have a stellar reputation, they're, more often than not, you're going to find that they had a byline to proceedings.
Yeah, that's a pretty important publication, and with good reason. I was going to ask you, how big is your staff now at USNI News, and are you guys looking to expand, do more stuff? What's the future for the news part?
Oh yeah, funny you should ask that. So we have 3 full-time staff now. So there's me. We have Megan Eckstein, who's the deputy USNI News editor. She's fantastic. She is getting back from Room of the Pacific exercise. She has been doing a lot of traveling for us lately. And then we hired Ben Werner, who has a background in business reporting. He's a real good reporter, and you're going to be seeing a lot more sort of the intersection of defense and business coverage, particularly around the sea services, in what we're doing. I mean, not busy business stuff for business sake, but, how does the industry component of this, work for the operational side, and how do all of these gears mesh together? Because they do. So for USNI News in the future, we've been in the middle of a series of specific, thinking about what we want to do in the future. If there's stuff you want to see at USNI News, hit me up on Twitter at Sam Lagrone. Yeah, at Sam Lagrone, SAMLAGRONE. But we're thinking about like the Navy specifically because, you know, we're in this transition period. That sea service is going to look to expand to from 284 ships to ostensibly 355, you know, adding a ton of personnel on there. So they're, it's an organization that it has to grow at a pretty rapid clip at a point where, you know, is the industrial base able to sustain it? Are they going to be able to find enough people to be in the Navy? How are you going to be able to train up all these people? So you're looking at, you know, just some major organizational challenges that the Navy in particular is faced with, more so pretty much, I think, than any other service. I think, you know, if you look at like the portfolio of stuff that the Navy's working on right now, there's a ton of things, right? You know, so you've got the block, you've got the Columbia class, you have the Columbia class ballistic missile submarine coming online right now. You know, that's going to start cutting metal, I think 2019, 2020, getting ready for its first patrol in 2030. That's just a massive engineering exercise right there. You have, you know, trying to figure out what's eventually going to replace the SA-18. That process is happening now. What's the next future surface combatant going to look like? Because the Arleigh Burke design, granted, we're going to be doing Flight 3 for a minute, but it's pretty long in the tooth. That's a tight ship without that's a tight hull design without a whole lot of margin to grow. Do you put a plug in the middle of it and call it a Flight 4, or do you really do something new? There's a lot of challenges going there moving forward. You know, hypersonics versus subsonic as far as anti-ship missiles. You know, are we still going to work with the railgun, lasers? You know, there's a whole, you know, the Navy is the biggest story for us right now, I think, because they were, I don't want to say in a state of stasis, but they kind of were. I mean, they weren't on the front of everybody's imagination, you know, during the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was funny. I was looking at some pictures of the initial insertion of U.S. Marines into Afghanistan, I want to say in 2002, or Marines in 2002. And if you look at those Marines then, I think they just had gotten MARPAT, but they were slinging M16A2s. I think a lot of them still had some of the old the old load bearing equipment, and they look like dinosaurs from another era. And it wasn't that long ago. I mean, at least as long as I've been a journalist. And you look at the Marines now, and you see what they carry, and you know all the crazy sights and all the new body armor and all the new everything. And you do the same thing with the Army. I mean, how many generations of evolution in small unit infantry tactics and equipment happened because of those conflicts, because that's what everybody was focused on, and that's where all the innovation was. I mean, look at the Humvee versus the JLT. I've ridden it both. I had to tell you, it is amazing. You know, that the JLTV versus the Humvee is a, you know, several generation jump in capability for what they were trying to do, especially about the mine, you know, the mine resistant component of that. That being said, where's that in the Navy? Where's that in the Navy? What's the anti-ship weapon right now? It's the Harpoon. What was it in 1989? Pretty sure it was Harpoon. You know, so you have this service that has to do a lot of growth really, really quickly when all of the other services, you know, when they didn't really have the attention of, I think, legislatures and the nation at the time. Now what they're doing in this era of new great power competition is front and center. And they have to grow really, really fast. And being able to understand that from an operational sense, from a strategic sense, from a financial sense, and then how all the legislation is going to turn out of that is going to be a real, you know, it's going to be as far as I'm concerned, the military story of the next decade, because it's the Navy's time now to take a look at. And based on that, our job is to try and figure out how to explain how big these big muscle movements are to, like, you know, regular Joe on the corner. So we're thinking, how are we going to do that? And so we've got a couple of ideas. If I would advise people, if you haven't been to the USI News YouTube channel, we're starting to do some more explainer short form documentaries we've been working on that for about a year and a half. We're spinning up. We're going to have a bunch of stuff coming out of RIMPAC, hopefully in the next month or so. So that's part of it. So we're looking more into ultimately finding the tools that we need to explain the Navy to the general public and the DC folks. Sorry, that was a much longer answer than I intended, but you got me in a roll there.
No, that's a great answer. And hey, Sam, it's been a real fast hour and change. Really appreciate you taking time to come on. I'd encourage everybody. You know, Sam's mentioned his Twitter handle here. If you're not following him already, go ahead. He links to a lot of the stuff, not just that he writes, but that other people write. And I, as always, will keep an eye on you, Sam. Keep up the good work.
All right.
I want to go along with that and also note that the USNI news on the USNI website is not behind a paywall. So you can actually read all this stuff without having to join the Naval Institute, although I would highly recommend you do. Anyway, thanks a lot.
I highly recommend everybody else join the Naval Institute. Please do it. It funds a lot of, you know, news.usni.org is the web address. And it is a public service that we do. We feel it's our civic responsibility to inform the public the best that we can. You know, we're a nonprofit news organization. However, you know, it is provided to the public by our members and by their membership. So, again, I would encourage everyone who's listening, join the Naval Institute. It's totally worth it.
And there we go. Thanks a lot, Sam, and I look forward to next opportunity to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Phil.
Yes, sir. And thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And just to make sure, give y'all a heads up, next week, we're going to be discussing AI and machine learning with Allie Crawford from the Patterson School. And then on the 12th, we're going to have Nate Finley and Ty Mayfield on to discuss their work on refining the modern military. Appreciate y'all joining us. Till next time, have a great Navy day.
It's a long way to go. It's a long way.